Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. You're listening to a previously recorded show, Foundations of Estate Planning. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, we're continuing a discussion we started last week on foundations of trusts and creating trusts. And you want to review a little bit about what we talked about last week before we get into this week's section?
So the premise of what we're talking about is, if someone were to walk into my office, what questions would I ask them and why? So what is the foundation of the questions I need to ask? What's the reasoning behind it? And there's things that we want to talk about. We did talk about last week about how do we name a trust? What type of name do we use? Who do we include in a trust as far as beneficiaries? What if we're going to disinherit a trust, someone? So all that can be found at a previous podcast at legacyandfaith.com. But I want to continue the discussion and move deeper into some of the questions that we would ask, specifically revolving around what would it look like in a trust model to protect the client. I talk a lot about my first objective is to ensure that the client is well taken care of and that they are going to be protected and that their assets are going to be used for their purposes during their lifetime. And so how do we do that in a trust compared to where maybe sometimes we think of estate planning of, oh, my kids are going to get the money. Okay, but there's so much more. There's steps before we ever get to who gets the money that I need to make sure my clients are well organized and that they are going to be using their finances appropriately, specifically if someone else comes in to help the client. And what does that look like? So that's going to be our topic for today. What does it mean to put together and what questions would I ask, put together a trust that revolves around how do I protect my clients during their lifetime?
Okay, so we want to move into the section now of how to make sure that the client is the person that is taken care of first in this estate and this this trust plan.
Yeah, so when we walk through this process, some of the questions that we need to start with are, well, what is the vision of how you want to be cared for? So what does that look like? We call it disabled. Now, there's a couple ways that we can determine that someone needs assistance. Okay, that's my definition of disabled. You need assistance for one reason or another. In other words, you can't manage your financial affairs. Maybe you can't get to the mailbox. Maybe you're unable to write your checks. Maybe there's competency issues and you're forgetting to pay your bills. Okay, so someone else needs to step in and now begin to manage that. So the first question then that we need to ask clients is, how do we determine that you have reached that point? So what is the process involved? Now, traditionally, we've used in the legal world a traditional one doctor or two doctors to examine you, make a determination that you do not have competency, and therefore someone else needs to be empowered. Now, that tool that would be empowered can either be a financial power of attorney or it can be empowered as a successor trustee. Now, there are place for doctors, that is for sure, but there are other options that sometimes people would prefer to take advantage of in estate planning. And so the question that I pose to clients is, how do we make the determination? And the other option is, do we want to use a family and private opportunity to make a determination that you need assistance? So if I'm walking around the backyard in my underwear, my wife would know if that's normal or not normal for Paul Grant. Okay. I live in the city. So
I had a family member who actually had that exact scenario.
Yeah. Okay. So it's even closer to home. I live in the city. That's not normal. You need at least 5 acres or more before it becomes normal. Okay. So my wife would be the first person who has the opportunity to know whether I am acting within the same characteristics that I normally act in. Okay, she would see something's going on, and so number one, how important would her voice in the process be? Well, for me personally, her voice would be instrumental. It would be critical that her opinion be known, that she have a say in the process of whether or not I am able to manage my life in the same way that I had been in the past. Now, if you're single or even if you're married, then there are other people that we can build this kind of board around you with, which are, do you have siblings? Do you have best friends? Do you have people that you go to church with? Who are the people in your corner? Who's in your village that you implicitly trust, that you then would say, if I am not doing well, that person would know. That person would be able to make the determination, and they wouldn't make that determination based upon selfish gain or wants. They would do it because it's in my best interest. And what I have seen is when we use a family or friend orientated process instead of a doctor driven process, then the individual who we are talking to tends to be more receptive that, yes, I need help. I don't like admitting this, but yes, I need the help. It is amazing. We are created in the image of God, and He is self-sustaining. He needs no one else to sustain Himself. And some of that characteristic is certainly dropped within us to where we have this nature within us that says, I can do it. I don't need or want other people in certain aspects of my life. And this tends to be one of them, which is, give me your car keys. Oh, have you ever wrestled car keys away from somebody? Oh my goodness. Okay. Because what we're taking away is independence. Mm. And so there is that that internal nature that says, you are not going to take my independence from me. Writing bills, being involved in finances. There are certain areas of our life that we are going to rise up and fight for that independence and to hold on to that power in our life. That's just how we are. And so if we have a family way to approach this circumstance, if we have developed that I have said, these are the people I trust, and if they say it, then I'm more likely to believe it than being drug off to a clinic and see a doctor that I may not have as much of a relationship with, and they send me through a litany of tests that are competency driven, to where they don't know my background. They don't know my story. They may have not seen the progression, and they're hearing it secondhand. Now, I am not degrading that process, and I'm not suggesting that there's not a place for that process. I have many clients who put disability process in the hands of physicians. They're extraordinary, competent doctors with compassion and care. So I'm not saying that that is a wrong process. I'm saying that there is another process for people to consider. And just what I've seen is that a majority of people would prefer to use an internal family process, specifically if they're married. They want the voice of their spouse. So,
sure.
So
and you don't know how long you're going to have that doctor either. Our doctor resigned a couple of years ago, and we were seemed like the last people to find out.
Yeah, right.
We had to find a new doctor now.
Yeah. So what if you're having a health incident and you go to that doctor, and all of a sudden that doctor's not there? And so there can be practical reasons to use people who are more steady in your life. Now, it doesn't mean that everyone pushes a doctor to the side. Some people say, look, I'm going to entrust these friends or these family members to make this critical decision. And I would suggest that it's probably one of the most important decisions that we're going to make for you. Because if we put a group of individuals that you trust around you And they have the power to say you can no longer manage your financial assets. You need assistance to manage things in your life. We're taking your power and control away. That is a big, big deal. So some people would say the doctor doesn't get a vote in the process, but I also want a medical evaluation to give to the people that I've been trusting so that they at least have the wisdom to it.
How often is a law firm appointed as sort of like the main go-to?
Well, but okay, so that's a little bit of a different question. That's different actually question. Getting into the next question, which is who then takes over? Maybe, Mark, what I hear your question to be is if I'm found to be incompetent or disabled, then who takes over?
Yeah.
So I would never make a sole determination on my client should not be in charge of their finances. That's not my position. I'm here to write the documents and to ask questions and to develop a plan.
But if you have no family, you know, that scenario, you need somebody in your corner.
Yep. And so then we're going to be looking towards who are the people in your life? Who do you have? What are the relationships? Who are they? And oftentimes we do need to settle back into the more traditional, I want a doctor to evaluate me, and it takes a doctor's note to take my power away, or it takes two doctors to have my power taken away. So yes, there is a medical process that we can default to that is very traditional. But I guess for the purposes of today and what we're talking about, this is a foundational question that we have to unravel with each client, which is how do you want to give up your power and control? Mm. That's a big deal. And so it takes some time to think through this process. And then we also need, if we use a trust, we also need a financial power of attorney. We always need a financial power of attorney, even with a trust. And that language should also be mirroring and have similar attributes as the trust. So I can't have a financial power of attorney saying, go get a doctor to be enacted, and then the trust saying, but use my family members to for this process. So we have multiple documents that need to line up and that we are asking these foundational questions for. But I think this is one of the bigger questions I ask is, typically people know who are going to get their money if they were to pass away. But not many people have gone through the thought process of how do I make the determination that I need help? And so it's a pretty big question. It's a pretty big result that you are empowering others, whether it's doctors or whether it's family members. And I want my spouse to be involved. So how does all of that work together to make sure that we get to the right conclusion so that the vision of the client is going to be enacted and there's a higher likelihood that client is going to accept that process because they developed it instead of resisting it, of being drugged to a doctor like the traditional system would.
Okay, looking at foundational questions in creating a trust for you and your family. If you like Paul's approach and you want to find out more about his services, how do people get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's Legacy and Faith.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. You're listening to a previously recorded show, Foundations of Estate Planning. I hope you enjoy it.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, we're discussing with Paul his approach to foundational questions, issues that need to be talked about as you have a trust created by he and his services. And Paul, we wanted to talk about what's called the successor trustee now.
Right.
How do you pick that person that's going to kind of be in charge?
Yeah, if there's two times when we need a successor trustee, and one is if you've gone through the panel or a doctor, whichever one a client chooses, and you are deemed to be needing assistance, right? So you're deemed, quote unquote, incompetent. Now you shouldn't be managing your financial affairs. So now someone else needs to come in and manage and take responsibility for paying the bills, for managing the investments, for collecting the statements and making sure that the financial household is running smoothly. The second time we need a successor trustee is when someone passes away. So we need a successor trustee to come in, and that looks very different than if someone is disabled, because now we have to close the estate and we have to start protecting things and dividing things into the beneficiary's portion. So those are very, very different roles based on the scenario.
In the disabled scenario, how often is it not the spouse, assuming they're married?
So most typical, the first person that is going to take over is a spouse. You're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, in a married circumstance, that is the expectation. If one of us is not doing well, the other one takes over. And because they are both trustees, so in Washington State, we are a community property state, so we build a joint trust, meaning it's a together trust. We create one instrument, and both spouses use that instrument together. Now, there are exceptions to that if it's a second marriage, if you have separate property. So there are circumstances when you may need two different trusts. But for the most part, generally, we're going to create one together trust. And both spouses, if they are competent and able, are going to be trustees. So if one trustee is deemed to not be able to manage anything any longer, then the other trustee is still there holding the power and responsibilities. So what happens then if you're single, or if both spouses are needing assistance at the same time? Now we have another person come in, and they're going to bump the hands off, and they're going to be the successor trustee. They're going to take over. And so who do we need to step up to the plate? Well, we need someone that you fully trust with your finances. I typically ask clients to name the one person that they want as the successor trustee. I have some clients that push back on that. It's their plan. I am happy to do whatever you desire. But typically, I would rather see one person manage the assets, both for some legal reasons and some practical reasons. So the legal reasons are that, what if we have a disagreement? Who wins? So do we have to bring in a third party? Do we have to make a tie-breaking scenario that if the two trustees cannot see eye to eye, most instruments, most powers of attorney, most trusts are going to say that there must be agreement between, there must be this joinder between the trustees. But very, very few documents have ever given conflict resolution process or procedures for when they don't. So I don't know about you, but my daughters are completely different people. They don't have the same temperament. They don't have the same thought processes about money. And yet they were raised in the same household by my wife and I. And so therefore, if I put them back together and they already have different values and viewpoints on how to manage money, let alone how to manage my money, if that was the case, there is an opportunity then for them to butt heads. And then what happens at that time? Now, many clients would come to me, oh no, they're best friends. They're as thick as thieves. Until money gets involved, until the emotions are higher. Because think of the scenario. I'm having difficulty. I am at a weak point that they need to come in and now take over things. So emotions are high. I've interrupted their lives. So I've thrown them off of their normal routine and their lives. And now I've teamed them up to say, you guys must agree. Boy, I'm telling you, that is a good recipe for conflict. Mm. That's a great recipe for conflict. So now there's some practical things, which is if two people are trustees and we send them off to say to my bank is going to say, great, we need both trustees here to sign the new signature cards and to do everything. Well, what if one of my daughters, like she does, lives in California compared to here? Now we got to pass documents around. We got to figure out how to get signatures, IDs. She's got to go do something down there versus up here. So oftentimes there are legal restrictions from the institution that we're trying to manage the money with. So what if that institution says, well, in order for us to honor something, both trustees have to sign instead of just one? Mm. Does the document say that both trustees must agree? Most financial institutions don't even read the document. So even if I put in there one trustee's signature is fine, they won't even see that. So from my perspective, both on a legal front and on a practical front, I would always suggest that we find the one person that you trust to manage your estate, to manage your financial affairs. Yes, it is going to put them out. And yes, they can hire other people. So they can hire an accountant. They can hire a bookkeeper. They can hire other people to get assistance. So that is a possibility. It doesn't mean that the weight of the world has to be on their shoulders. It means that we need someone who is organized, who has the ability and the space in their life to assist you, to gather the financial bills, to pay them. Maybe nowadays it's actually easier. They can set up automatic payment. They can set up auto bill pay through your bank. Mm. So there's a lot of ways that we can make their job easier nowadays than ever before. And yes, they can live out of state even. They don't have to be right next to you. So the question that I pose to people is, who do you implicitly trust with your finances? And sometimes that may be a sibling, but then siblings tend to be the same age as the client. So then their concern is, but how long until my sibling has a health issue, or how long can they actually perform this function? It's okay. We're going to ask for backups so that if your sibling is the best person today, then name them. But we're going to have a backup to that person so that if they have the health incident, if they are not able to do it, if they simply don't want to do it, then we're going to have that backup. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be somebody right next to you. We can get mail to them. There's ways that we can make their job much easier. They can hire other people. The question is, who do you implicitly trust with your finances that can also be able to perform the function? So if you have a child in their 30s and they have two small children, probably not the best person, even if they are very administrative in their personality, even if you implicitly trust them. What would it honestly look like if they had to take up the responsibility and now we're going to ask them? And by the way, in their 30s, they have a job and they have a spouse and they have kids. And now they're going to, now you're going to put on additional burden to say, and by the way, you get to assist me. Mm. So what would the practical life look like of the person that we're asking to step into that role? Mm. So there's multiple facets of picking the right person to manage your financial affairs should you ever be deemed that you need assistance and that you're unable to manage your own financial affairs. Here's a couple other things that I'll mention as we start to close out our show today. By Washington law, that person cannot have a felony. So if they made a mistake in their 20s, it turned their life around, they're doing great in life, but if they have been convicted of a felony, And it does not quantify that it's a financial – that the felony has to be associated with some type of
– Can't be a trustee.
Cannot be a trustee.
Successive trustee.
Yep. Cannot be a trustee. You can over your own trust, but you cannot be for someone else. Mm. Or if – it's called moral turpitude in law. It's the craziest old term. But really what it means is that you stole money. And so if someone has ever been convicted of not managing money on someone else's behalf with integrity, it may have not been a felony, but they are disqualified as well. Mm-hmm. So people are shocked when I say, has the person that you just named that you trust, have they ever been convicted of a felony, not accused of, but into your knowledge, mom and dad, have they ever been convicted of a felony? And it's a surprising question, but it's one I have to ask because I don't want to ask that person and then all of a sudden go through the disqualifications and handing it off. We want to sort that out at the very beginning. Mm. So who manages your estate? They're going to have a lot of power. They're going to have a lot of control. They're going to have accessibility to your accounts. They're going to have the decisions of selling and paying bills and what bill is appropriate. They may even need to sell your home and other things like this. And so I want to pick up this thought process next week and talk about, well, what are some of the things that we instruct a successor trustee in a trust document? And how does that compare really to a financial power of attorney? So I want to pick up these type of ideas and continue this conversation next week.
Okay, looking at foundational questions in creating a trust for you and your family. You're intrigued by Paul's approach to this subject and you want to find out more about his services. How do people get in touch with you, Paul?
Yeah, head over to my website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, and ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.